Well, good morning to all. We are back for our next session of identity, and we're going to talk principally about two things today. One is we wanted to look at some biblical examples of who in the Bible has something that we might want ourselves, i.e., someone who could say very clearly, I am this for God, or my job was that for God. So that kind of clarity, I imagine, is what you want. Let me know if that's not what you're looking for. But that's the kind of clarity I want. What does God want me to do, and what is my identity in Him? And I last time tried to make the point that the two are very much linked, that your identity with God, in God, has almost everything to do with your purpose for God. Or maybe another way of saying it is, based on your identity, God will have a purpose for you. Now, which one kind of comes first? I'll tell you, I don't really know. Does God say, you know, this is Al, and because of who Al is, my purpose is going to be X with Al? Or does God say, I know Al's will, I'm going to put Al in this body right here, and with this purpose, and that's going to be Al. It is that thing from which Al is going to draw his identity. Maybe another way of saying it is this. If it turns out that Al was, in the bloodline of the British Crown, and they, you know, everybody gets in the British Crown gets killed in an aircraft accident, and they run all the lines, and they find out Al's the King of England now, after everybody else has been disqualified. Congratulations, Your Majesty. Yes, actually, I think we took the large bulk of it, from my understanding. Would we have said, Al has been the king, and now that will be his purpose? Or do we now say, because of this blood lineage, Al's identity, you know, was Al's identity that he was the king, and now that's his purpose? Or do what we say is, your purpose is to be the king, and then from that he will derive his identity? So, some people might parse it and care. In my opinion, they're so closely related, it's almost like the chicken or the egg question. In the grand scheme of things, it doesn't matter. Chickens lay eggs, and you get eggs out of chickens. So for that reason, you might not care about it. So that's the way that I would look at it. But at any rate, it's going to give you identity and purpose being very closely, almost inextricably intertwined. So talk about Moses today, because I think that he's one of the most interesting identity studies in the Bible. And then the thing that we'll talk about next is whether you have a single identity, or whether your identity might change based on the circumstance. And I'll explain what I mean by that, because I'm equivocating on the word identity there. And by identity, I'm not going to just talk about self-identity, as in my name is Scott and this is the person that I am, and that I may be different persons in different scenarios. I'm really talking about, do I have different roles? So that's something we'll get on as well. But hopefully everybody had a chance to at least glance at some of the texts in which Moses was mentioned. But let's start from the beginning. If I asked you right now, who is Moses? What would you say Moses' identity in God is? Or if you want to say it in terms of purpose, what would you say Moses' purpose was for the kingdom? So just throw out whatever you think.
To lead the Jews out of Egypt.
Okay. Leader of the Exodus. Okay. What else?
Chosen from birth.
Okay. Chosen from birth. And I'm going to make you say, for what? Is it enough to be simply chosen? Chosen for what?
Chosen from being right out of the water into the Pharaoh's daughter's arms.
Chosen
for his entire life.
Okay, so chosen, not only the above, but chosen to be the leader. Okay, got it. What else?
Intermediary between God and the Israelites.
Yeah, that's a big one. I'll use that word, intermediary. Anything else? And in reality, from God to the rest of the world, at least to Egyptians and Hebrews. Okay, what else? Anything else?
Well, he was definitely chosen, but he was also to serve God's purpose.
Yes. Yes. Yes, it would. I'll, for the sake of brevity, put it in here. But that notion of purpose is exactly the core of what we're driving at. Absolutely. What else? If Moses was identifying himself to somebody, like he, like the Transfiguration, he appears, and except instead of to Peter and John or whomever, some guys from Malaysia that have never even heard any of the story, and he's like, "I'm Moses," and they're like, "Who's Moses?" And he was like, "Well, I." So he might say these things. What else might he say?
Should we include, you know, like perspective of past, present, and future tenses when we're thinking about this?
I don't. If you hope, so has anybody been forced to read the Iliad and the Odyssey? Did anybody actually read the Iliad and the Odyssey? Or did you read the Iliad, you started the first chapter, you read the second chapter, you're like, it's exactly like the first chapter. You read the third chapter, you're like, never mind, I'll get the cliff notes. So sometimes I feel that way about the Iliad.
Not only that, Homer was a good painter too.
Homer was, yeah, but he was blind, that's a, or well, lame, he was lame. No, it was, Homer was blind, that's right.
Yeah, he was blind. What was
Achilles after the whole time? What did he want?
Good shoes.
What did they all get? If only he had some good steel-toed or steel-heeled shoes. What did he want? What did the Greeks were after one thing alone in all of this endeavor. I mean, other than the wife of Agamemnon. Agamemnon? No. Menelaus, thank you. Obviously, it's been a long time since I read the Iliad. What did the Greeks want? Anybody remember?
Didn't they want power?
They did. But Achilles wasn't into the power thing. Achilles wanted something in particular. If you, I will not encourage you to go back and read it. All about an everlasting name. All about glory. That's what those guys were about. And if you go to some of the even churches, and I think that these were, I cannot remember whether this is a Notre Dame in cathedral in Paris or if it's somewhere else. But there's a set of statues of the 12 worthies. And these are people who embodied virtue. And in a church, Achilles is one of them. Hector was one of them. I'm sorry. Hector was one of them. And, yeah, you know, entirely opposite side of that one. But the idea was those who were seeking a name that lasted beyond their own time, that was something, legacy was something they were after. They wanted legacy. So, and it, absolutely, I think that we all want something eternal. And for people who don't have the hope of rising again and living eternally, what's the next best thing you can have? You want to be like Newton or Einstein or Mother Teresa or fill in the blank with somebody famous who's passed who still touches the world today in a real world. That's kind of something that we might want for ourselves. And if it's not, yes, if it's not that kind of fame, if it's not that level of fame, it's at least you know that what you did was good and lasted through the ages. Or to steal from a movie I'm sure everybody has seen, Gladiator, what does he say about our deeds in this world?
They echo
in eternity, exactly. Another Marine I'm sure would have remembered that one. Okay, so yes, that's a long answer to a short question, but I bring it up because the a lot of who we want to be ought to be an eternal identity. So if it is true, if anybody hasn't seen a pastor somewhere do the, you know, he has a big old long rope and he coils it around on stage or it's running through the whole church or whatever, and he's taped off a section this big, and he talks about, like, this is your life until you die and this is the rest of eternity, and he asks you to imagine that it keeps running all the way around the earth and all that kind of stuff or something like that. If your identity, I mean, imagine you're here in eternity and people are like, "So who are you?" And you're like, "Well, I'm the guy back here at the very beginning of the rope that did, you know, this thing." You almost want your identity to be something that carries throughout this whole string in a real and continuous way. So with that as background, if that's not enough of a too high a bar to set, what else might we want that might be longer lasting than, or how, what might Moses be to the ages? So these are all temporal things. He was the leader. He is no longer. He was chosen to be the leader. I guess he's kind of always got that, but that was an event in the past. He was the intermediary from God to the Hebrews and the Egyptians, but that's no longer the case either. So who else was he?
Well, the reason I brought the past, present, future up is because in effect he was more or less a concept of a savior.
Yeah, in some ways. How do the Hebrews refer to him in that vein? How do the Hebrews refer to Moses? What do they call him? Say again. They do call him deliverer in this vein. I'll put that up there as well. What is their primary title for him? Anybody know? What was his major role in their mind? After the delivery, what was the long-term thing that he did that Jews live by today?
Lawgiver.
Exactly it. He is the lawgiver. And if you ask a Jew what Moses' identity is, the first thing they will probably tell you, I would imagine, I may be wrong about this, but that he's the lawgiver. So Moses is the lawgiver. What else? Anything else that you would put up there? You're Moses' PR guy or gal. What are you going to put on the list? What do you want people to know?
The Red Sea.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Don't mess with my client because he will slap two sides of the ocean against your head. Yep, right. Miracle worker, we could say, yes. What a, what else? Anything else?
Isn't it talks to God? I mean, you kind of have it with the intermediary, but...
This is important because when you see other mentions in Scripture, they say Moses, who spoke face to face with God. That's like, they're saying that's almost as good a thing as you can get in the... trying to think of some modern examples kind of there, but you might to the Catholic believer, this might be someone like the equivalent might be today on a lower level might be something like, you know what, this guy meets with the Pope. You know, you're like, oh, okay, I got it. He's that level. It doesn't get any higher than this right here. He met face to face with God. And in the history, in the Jewish history since that time, who else had that experience? I mean, really, really nobody is talked about as having that done at that level. So this is a guy who is considered an intimate of God's. This is someone who really knows him. All right, what else? Anything else? It's a pretty impressive list so far. I'm not like I'm saying Moses is short here, but let me say it this way. If you had been Moses and you were a part of all the things that you saw in Exodus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and all that, what would you want people to remember you as?
A lasting example of a good servant to God.
All right. Good servant, yep. What else? Anything else you would want? Okay, so we'll take this list as partial from now. Feel free to add to it at any time. I'm going to flip very briefly over to Paul for 1 second. Paul, Saul of Tarsus, Paul of the New Testament. Do you think it's a coincidence? So God, let's say, is looking for someone, looking for a will, a person, an identity that he's going to use to be the missionary to the Gentiles. He's going to carry the word of a Jewish Messiah. This is the Jewish nation. This is who the Jewish people are on. Their Messiah has come. And as it turns out, he's not just there to save the Jew, but also the whole world, the Gentile included. And God says, I also want that guy to write the majority of the New Testament and basically all of the important theology in it as well that is stated. You know, there's important theology, of course, in the Gospels. It's the source material. But the person who first expounds on those and has a canonical set of writings that I'm going to make that guy's list. Is it a coincidence? Did God put on a blindfold and be like, oh, what fortune? The student of Gamaliel, Hebrew of Hebrews, a Benjaminite who was circumcised on the eighth day and a Pharisee. You think it was a coincidence that happened? It's a very leading question. Objection, Your Honor, leading the witness. It's your witness. Do you think that was a coincidence? Probably not, I would say. It seems to me that God said, these are some of the things of whom Saul of Tarsus is. And because I can work all things together for good, I'm going to take this Hebrew of Hebrews and make him the person to do this because he's highly literate. He speaks Greek and Aramaic and Hebrew. He understands the scriptures as good or better than any rabbi at the time. He's a student of the greatest rabbi of the age. That's the perfect guy. That's the perfect guy for God to choose. What about Moses? Is it, if Moses, God is looking at the whole nation of Israel, and maybe 600,000 men plus is what the Bible says, that walked out of Egypt on that day, plus women and children. He's got 1 million people to look at. Why does he pick this guy?
Because he's been raised in the home of the enemy.
All right, you got two. There's one. That's the big one half. Is one is Moses was the son, adopted son of Pharaoh's daughter. What does this give him that another Hebrew slave doesn't have? What's God have? What's Moses' job? When God speaks to him out of the bush, he tells him, what does he want him to go do?
Convince Pharaoh to let the Israelites go.
Yeah, step one is go to the court of Pharaoh and tell him to let my people go. Who's got access to the court of Pharaoh? All right, so what I want you to understand is your situation in life will tell you, give you a clue as to what your identity or purpose might be. So if you're making bricks and you're gathering straw and you're wondering to yourself, because you're an American and they've told you since you're this tall, like you can be president, you can be a Nobel Prize winner, you can be, you know, an astronaut, you can be anything that you want to be. And by the time we grow up to this age, we're like, that was all false. There's nothing on the list of what they told me I could do, could I actually do, probably.
Well, they didn't tell us we had to live in Indonesia.
Right. So there's some key data there that they don't actually fill you in on the whole time. By the way. So I wonder if there is something that you can draw identity-wise from where you are, your situation in life. In Moses' case, now by the way, I'll get to that in a second. So that's half of it right there. He's already got, basically, he's in the position to do the work that God wants him to do. The average slave in Egypt, the Hebrew slave in Egypt, is not. Now, it's not that God couldn't do that, but God, what a pattern I want you to see biblically is God will have a habit of doing this. He pulls people out that have some lineage or purpose that points toward it. It's not the case all the time. A great example is this. Who are you going to found your church on if you're Jesus? Now, maybe the first choice ought to have been Paul, but the first choice ends up being, or not found, who's kind of the first among equals amongst the apostles. The fisherman guy who can't keep his mouth shut and goes running off at, you know, completely out of control every time that he can. So I'm not saying that's always the case. But in the case of Moses, there was something he could have known from this right here. All right, what's the other half? There's a very unique statement in the Bible. It only says it once about one person. And it says, now Moses, it almost looks like a parenthetical comment. Says, now Moses was the most blank person on the earth. Anybody know what the blank is? Humble. Moses was the most humble man on the earth. If you remember, I don't know if you have heard it, but if you heard Pastor Mike's sermons, I want to say they were probably a year ago or so, maybe two. He talked about humility as the foundation. He didn't necessarily phrase it exactly this way, but he's basically like, it's the most foundational of the virtues. If you have humility, it's likely that you'll have the foundation for a bunch of other virtues. But if you don't have humility, if you have these other virtues, you're likely not to have them in great depth, or you're likely not to have as many of them. That humility is really the first of the virtues. Now, that's a unique idea. I don't know I've heard anybody else advance it before, but I think it's a good one in that it's at least, here's one case where it seems to be correlated highly. The most humble guy on the face of the earth also is the only guy who gets to do this. Now, when we talk about Christ, when he came, the Bible uses the word humble in several portions talking about what Christ does. So humility ought to be the least humble of the Hebrew slaves, right? He's in the highest position. He's got the most reason to naturally, socially, educationally, whatever else, hold himself up above everybody else. But what does the Bible say he is? He is the most humble of all of them. And he's the one that gets to do this. Jesus, who is this, adapts humility as the way to go. This, I think, is very important. And so one of the things I would encourage you to do is, for those who are interested in finding out what your identity is and in maximizing what your identity is, and I don't want to go into what I mean by maximizing, but you know what I mean. You want to be all you can be. You want to be all you can be for God. Start with humility. If you start with humility, you're in good company. Jesus and Moses, right? I'll just leave those two there and work your way from there. So let humility be the first trait that you have. And we'll talk about humility a little bit, maybe not today, maybe next time. But humility, I'm probably not the best guy to talk about it. But I can at least tell you what I've learned about it. Humility, humbleness is something to pursue. And it is actually a key part of Moses' identity. A key part of Moses' identity is that he's a humble man. Now, what does Jesus say, paradoxically, that really gets us wrapped around the axle occasionally, and we still admit we don't know. We don't know what it means. When it comes to being rewarded in heaven, when it comes to being getting into the kingdom of God, what does Jesus say? Who? Exactly. The first shall be last, and the last shall be first. You know, I recommend you to this one, the Beatitudes. Blessed are the meek. They shall inherit the earth. Blessed are the poor. And he talks about people that we would otherwise put in humble conditions. So I'm not saying become an ascetic right now. What I'm saying is this right here is somehow key to the identity of at least a couple now of key people in the Bible. So this is something we will talk about. Okay. Moses, this should make you feel good about, if you've ever thought about, well, if I'd have been in the Garden of Eden, I would have messed this up. Or if I'd have been in this situation, I messed this up. Moses is the first person since Adam, I think. To my knowledge, he's the first person since Adam. I'm not sure how he told Noah to build the ark kind of thing. But in the Bible, he's the first person since Adam to do this. And what does he do in the first 60 seconds? How's his interaction? Someone summarize his interaction with God. Yes.
Okay. He's like, don't send me.
get Noah.
I can't do this.
He's 60 seconds into being revealed, the God of the universe and of the Hebrews is revealed to him. He gets in an argument and tells God he doesn't know what he's talking about. All right, so if you've ever thought, I could never do this kind of thing, I'd mess it up. I bet you nobody in this room would have argued with God in the first 60 seconds and said, you don't know what you're talking about. Moses did that. So, and to the point where God has met Moses, Moses has met God. 2 minutes into it, what does it say about God? How did God feel towards the end of this conversation? And the anger of the Lord burned against Moses. And he said, your brother Aaron, and he lets Aaron be the speaker in here. God meets Moses, and within 2 minutes of it, Moses has got him mad. All right. Don't worry whether you are good enough to be who God has for you to be in your identity. You can't be worse than this. You can't be worse than Peter, who denies him 3 times when it counts. You know, you can't be worse than Paul, who killed Christians on his way into the kingdom, right? So take encouragement from some of the heroes of the faith, 3 people that we would almost be like, I would love to be that close to God. 3 of them made mistakes that you probably would not have made yourself. So don't think that God needs some kind of raw material to make amazing stuff out of. He uses situations, I think, to do so. But don't feel discouraged and feel like, well, maybe I don't have an identity in God. Maybe my purpose is not good enough. Maybe I can't really fulfill that purpose. This guy can. Okay. So Moses is supposed to go be the speaker. Now, I ask you this question. What if there was no Aaron, or what if he had accepted God ahead of time? Let's say that he stutters. He's not very good at public speaking. What do you think God would have done with him had he shown up to the court of Pharaoh? You know, I imagine that he would have been specially empowered to do so. Jesus makes this statement to his apostles. What does he say to them when they're dragged in front of kings and prelates and judges and whatever? How much preparation did he want them to put into their case, so to speak? He said, don't worry about it. The Spirit of God will give it to you to say at the time. And I almost like the thought of Moses walking into Pharaoh and being completely terrible at speaking. And he's like, everybody's like, hey, here's Moses. Here's Mr. I Can Barely Understand Him, Moses. Hey, old mutterer, what do you want? And Moses is like, God of the Hebrews says, let my people go. And he's like, get out of here. Moses is like, staff, snake. And everybody, you know, it's the whole drops mic, walks away kind of thing. It would have been even better if there wasn't anybody speaking, I feel like. But, you know, don't question God's plan, maybe the lesson from that one. But ultimately, there's another encouraging thing in there. Right off the bat, he does this. He gets God mad within 2 minutes. God, what does God do? Does God say, you know what, forget it, deal's off? What does he say? Plan B. Okay? You're not going to do what I asked you to do, plan A. I have a plan B. How many plans does God have for you? As many as you've got choices in your life. He's got a plan B, C, D, E, F, G, H, I, J, K. On down. So just because you mess something up doesn't mean, this is very important, just because you mess something up does not mean you lose your identity. Does not mean you lose your identity.
I can testify to that.
And I think all of us in this room can at some point. You know, has God still used us to do something of value somewhere in the kingdom? Yes, absolutely. So despite our own mistakes. In fact, I've said it before, I won't go through it again here. The reason I'm standing in front of you today is because of a series of mistakes, not because of a series of good choices, both on my part and, in my opinion, the part of one of the elders of Reston Bible Church as well. So it is not a foregone conclusion that if you are not perfect, then you lose your identity in Christ. I think there's more, like Achilles was after, glory to be gained in the long run. But what does a humble person, I'll do one quick nod towards humility. We strive for glory. Paul is very clear about this. There are a bunch of verses, you know, where Paul's talking about pressing on towards the glory of, and he fills in the blank with athletic metaphors, or he fills in the blank with just general descriptions of kind of the Hebrew understanding of glory, et cetera, and it seems to me. What does a humble person want glory for? How do you do that? How do you both gain glory and then give it to God? Those seem to me on the surface to be self-referentially incoherent. So what do we mean by that?
I mean, I think you see it with very few, but some athletes when, like, after a great game, a reporter will come up to them and say, "Wow, this was a great game. How are you feeling about that?" And they're like, "It wasn't me, it was God."
Right.
So any time that something amazing happens to you that seems to come from you, you say, no, this wasn't me. This is all because of him.
When somebody is truly humble and they recognize, let's say Newton, Isaac Newton, right? I was on a trip in London this week, talking to our military and Her Majesty's military as well. I went to Westminster Abbey, and I went to go visit the grave of Isaac Newton. And it's a cool, I'm going to see if I can figure out a way to not do the same thing, because I'm just not copying him. But it had a great saying in Latin. It's basically said, translated in English, "Here lies all that was mortal of Isaac Newton." I'm like, that's good. A little dualism poke for monists at the end there. But if Isaac Newton has all of this glory that we attribute to him of being one of the greatest scientists or philosophers of all time, what credit does he get for that? So what contributed to him being that guy? Why was he so good? What are some of the obvious things? He needed to be what?
Smart.
Okay, so he's got to have smart. Where'd the smart come from? Did he build that himself? No. Did he cultivate it himself? Like, can you go from being a guy with an IQ of 80 to a guy being an IQ of 120 if you just do the right memory exercises? There's things they'll try to sell you on Google that say that's a suggestion, but that's all. You can improve memory, but you can't actually improve what we call IQ. There's a long discussion about what that is and whether it's legitimate or not. But the bottom line is you can't just self-will to make yourself smarter. You can make good use of it. You can do a lot of things if you're not as smart as this person or that person. You can't just make yourself smarter. So he doesn't get any credit for that. What else do you have to be? He's sitting around thinking about the heavens. He's sitting under apple trees, all this kind of stuff. Does he get to do that if he's a farmer? No.
Not very often.
Right. Yeah, exactly. So he's got to be well-funded to the point where he can just sit around and think about stuff. Was that his responsibility? Now, if you read his biography, you'll find that all of him getting put into his position was divinely or societally, depending on what you believe in that sense, provided to him. So it was basically almost like, I understand there's will in there, and that will does have to be compliant. But if you're baking a cake and you've got the flour and all the other stuff, you know, oil and eggs and whatever else you put in it, and you put that into the cake mix, it would not be cake if you did not have those other pieces. So the flour doesn't get to sit there and be like, "I was the flour, I'm the real basis of this whole cake." The answer is you're nothing. You are not. You are a pile of stuff that nobody's going to eat if you don't have all of those things that happen to show up at the right time and get mixed up in the right order and all that kind of stuff. All of us are like that. So if we really do believe that God is the master chess player, There's only one thing that we ever contribute to any of our identity. All the rest of it comes from God. So I'll say it again. There's only one thing you ever contribute to your identity. Everything else comes from God. What's the one thing that you contribute? Yes. Yes. I'm going to get, see, look, that's humility right there. I can take glory for this, but she's the one that said it. That's exactly right. Free will. It's the, Mary, it's the question of Mary. So Mary, again, super humble. In fact, she might be appalled, depending on what is true about this. She might be appalled at how much glory she is given today. In some circles, she's practically, she's not worshipped, but she's revered as Mary, Queen of Heaven. She is certain. And what was her accomplishment? What did she do? You go read through the Gospels and you say, what did Mary do? I only see two things of note at all. What do you think they are?
One,
maybe three.
Her own birth.
Her
Jesus. Own immaculate conception.
Right. Well, I'm saying, what did she do? What did she do that you think was important? Okay, well, all right, before that, though, I mean, you know, that's like saying, okay, a pregnant lady, so if she gave birth to a baby, then that's no greater glory than any other mother, because they have also, their contribution to it was simply, I went through this painful process of giving birth.
Well, she was
a virgin. So I guess what I'm asking is, what was her exercise of will that was? Okay. Yeah, so this was may have been part of the grounds for the selection, but when it came to, basically God is saying your identity can be, you know, Theotokos in the Eastern Church, the bearer, God bearer, or mother of God, depending on how you want to think of her, no pun intended. The difference, this glory was only based on, are you willing to do this? And what was her response to the angel? After she asked the question of like, you know, I went through junior high. I got the class on how this works. So she was like, how's this going to happen? So I don't think she was being a smart aleck about it. I think it was just kind of like, am I missing something here? And he's like, nope, you're not missing anything. And what does she say?
Let it be.
Yeah, be it done to me as the Lord has said. So that is humility, and that is the only thing you contribute. And isn't that refreshing to you? Isn't that helpful to you? All you have to do to be the person that God wants you to be, to fill your destiny and purpose, your high calling, is just to say yes to God when he asks you. That's it. He doesn't ask you, he doesn't want you to come up with a plan. He doesn't want you to chart the course yourself. He doesn't want you to go to some extraordinary effort. All he wants you to do is say yes. Moses, I want you to do this. I don't want to do it. Fine, plan B. You and Aaron will do this. Okay, I'll do it. Mary, I want you to do this. How does this work? Don't worry about it. I got it covered. Okay, let's do it. Peter, yes. You don't even know the question yet. It's yes anyway. So, you know, that's some of why the people are chosen that are chosen is God knows that they are people who will say yes to him. So be humble in your search for your identity. And it's so simple that it looks stupid to write it on the board. Say yes to God. I'll give you a small example from my own life. You've heard this. This will be very brief. I'm teaching this class because of this. I'm teaching this class not because I said yes to come teach the class. I'm teaching this class because the guy that taught that class beforehand, Bereans, was named Ray Schoaf. I was in Ray's class, attending the class. He goes to Algeria on this thing won't describe it all, but it's basically a dialogue with Muslims that's kind of a missionary, an undercover missionary effort, it feels like almost. Some sort of NCIS, it was close to NCIS and church as you're going to get. And Jamie Winship was going to be there, and I like following him around and seeing what he's up to and what he's going to do and how he interacts with people. So Ray comes to me and says, Scott, I want you to go on this trip next year. And I said, in my own mind, I'm like, great, an opportunity to go to the Middle East and hang out in the desert again. Sign me up for that. Never. And I got to sense later that what Ray really wanted was, there was more talk of terrorism stuff. And he thought that being an old ex-Marine force recon guy and consultant at the time to SOCOM on technology stuff, right? that I was going to somehow get everybody out of trouble if we got kidnapped. And I was like, Ray, you realize I'm just another victim, right? You're going unarmed with no comms and no transportation, no way out, no QRF or medical team. I'm an extra body there to slow him down. That's the best I can give you right now. He'd watch too many movies. So I said yes to that, and I didn't want to go. But in the course of doing so, God used us all in a way that then made Ray say, you know what, you need to teach a class. We're in there, and I can't even speak Arabic, other than drop your weapon and put your hands in the air, which is not useful in that kind of dialogue. And he says, you have something that I want you to teach to our youth. You need to be teaching class to high school, etc. And obviously not the folks here. There's one or two, but ultimately, this was because I was obedient to my most minimal of responsibilities. What responsibility do I have as a member of RBC that I actually did right in this occasion? Would you say? An elder of the church, someone who's a leader in the kingdom of God over top of me, all of whom I disagree with theologically, all of them, asked me to do something, and I said yes. And now I'm teaching this class. Think about it this term. And by the way, I sat through Ray's class. Ray is a Reformed theologian and believes a very different concept than I do about free will and all that kind of stuff. And the whole time I'm thinking to myself, you know, Ray's a great teacher and his biblical exposition was excellent too. But the whole time I've got problems with this theology. Imagine I'm plotting. You know what I really want to do? I want to teach a class at Reston Bible Church where I can give the opposite side perspective, where I can give, you know, all this kind of stuff. What's the best path to doing there? To doing that. I know. Let's go to Algeria, hang out with a bunch of refugees, and go to a meeting I don't know about in the middle of the night with these other Muslim scholars, and I'll say something there that'll make Ray drop his objections to my theology, drop his, you know, fill in the blank with all these possible objections, and be like, come and do this thing. Does that sound like a reasonable plan I should have come up with? If so, you guys are better planners than I am. This is my point. Don't do God's... Know what your identity is, but know what your identity is not. Your identity is not mastermind of your own fate. Your identity is not self-determiner of what you will be. Your identity starts with this, and then it goes a little bit further, and God will tell you what your identity is. Don't you want to be told what your identity is rather than tell people what your identity is? If you think no, let me ask you to look at something in popular culture right now. What do we... I'm an absolute paranoid guy when I watch movies and whatever, because I and TV shows, because I think that people are intentionally putting anti-Christian messages into everything. I know that marks me as a little bit paranoid, but...
No, they are.
But, well, then maybe you're a little bit paranoid too, everybody would say. But the idea is, I do believe that, and I think that I can show good patterns of that. Anybody see the most recent Sherlock episode?
No.
The BBC one?
The BBC one, yes. Okay. Sherlock... who made you? This is Watson is sitting there talking to Sherlock. They're sitting and waiting for like somebody who they think is going to kill this country squire to come in and ambush him. And so they're on watch in the middle of the night. They're bored. And Watson is talking to Sherlock and basically being like, what's wrong with you, man? You're kind of a sociopath. Don't you have a girlfriend? Basically, that's the kind of thing he was talking about. And Watson says to Sherlock, kind of the culmination of the conversation is, Holmes, who made you like this? And he laughs and says what? Do you remember? He laughs and says, Watson, nobody made me. I made me. And the world loves to hear that. They're, yes, a self-made man, a person who made... The whole premise behind Sherlock, the new Sherlock, is that he's this genius, off-the-charts guy whose memory and logical abilities are just untouchable by the rest of us mere mortals. How does that even make sense to anybody?
Darwin sits up in his grave.
Yeah, it's not even a Darwinian hypothesis. It makes no sense from a genetic perspective, from a neurophysiological perspective, from a developmental perspective. Sherlock in no way contributed to his own genius, that the raw materials were there. Okay, so when we hear that, that is, in my opinion, an anti-Christian message. The Christian message would be, what's the Watson says to Sherlock? Sherlock, who made you like this? What would Sherlock's answer be if he was a Christian? God made me like this. And if there's anything wrong with it, it's because I chose to say no to him, and I twisted it a little bit.
To be fair, Sherlock is also self-described as a sociopath.
Yes, a high-functioning sociopath, but...
but a sociopath nonetheless. I don't disagree with what you're saying, that it's anti-Christian for him to say that, but he is self-described as a sociopath.
Because I feel sorry for you and your arm was hurt, I'll answer this question. But normally this is a soapbox I wouldn't get on. And apologies to everybody, including my psychologist wife, who she and I have had this discussion, and for the record, she does not disagree with this. Or at least I don't understand that she disagrees with this.
So it's okay for me to do it.
This is a Gaussian curve, the normal curve. All of psychology is about rating people against the norm. So when we say this person is a pyromaniac, what they mean is they like fire more than people who fit in this much of the curve do, or some number of standard deviations away from the curve. Normalization, that is to say, how far away you are from that part of the humanity, from what everybody else is like, is the basis of psychology. So when someone talks about a sociopath, what they're saying is this is somebody that doesn't care about the opinions of others. Now, in fairness to psychology, they've thrown several other indicators in there for someone to be truly classified as a sociopath, and in which part at least two of their terms are ones that I consider to be moral. But in all fairness, I've jokingly described myself as a sociopath, and what I mean by that isn't that I fit a clinical definition of sociopathy. What I mean is, I don't like being around people. I would rather be alone than anything else. I don't care about what other people think. My friends in college would talk about me behind my back to some of my leaders and be like, "What's the matter with Scott? Why doesn't he care about anybody's opinion?" And he gave him an answer back that I didn't deserve, which is basically like, he's just a guy that does the right thing. Those guys don't care about the other opinion. That's actually not the truth. There are people who deeply care about the opinions of other people and who deeply care about the right thing. I'm just not one of those people. I legitimately don't care what other people think. Now, that puts me at the level at which that happens. They rated me one time. I was 0-9 on a test meant to find that stuff out. That puts me over here. Now, if that's one of the criteria for being a sociopath, then I have that. Now, the other part that I don't have is I do have empathy. When somebody's hurt, I feel for them. Now, like Skyler can tell you, you can train yourself past that. So, if somebody's hurt in a combat situation, you do what you got to do, and you can feel sorry for them later. But ultimately, at the end of the day, when I hear about a kid, especially one that I know, getting hurt or whatever, I get up, that upsets me, kind of thing. True sociopaths, by the clinical definition, also are in this end of it when it comes to empathy. I think empathy is a moral thing. I don't think desire to be around other people is a moral thing. So the difference in clinical sociopathy and what Sherlock is referring to, Sherlock's moral choice is he chooses not to care about right and wrong. To him, solving murders is a game. It's something at which he passes his time. He doesn't care about the victims. He's very clear about that one. Compare that Sherlock to the actual fictional Sherlock from the Conan Doyle novels. What's the main difference between the two, for those that know the two? That Sherlock, yes, ma'am.
Well, he's really humble in all of them.
He really is.
He's always hiding his face. He doesn't want credit for anything that he's done.
Yep, and he actually cares in some sense about the victims. He values virtue. He's kind of the stereotypical Victorian Brit ideal in some ways, but that's absolutely right. And that's one of the, there are many things I don't like about the new Sherlock, but one of the things I dislike about it is they've left the core of his character. And I'm on my soapbox. I said I wouldn't get on too much. I'm about to get off of it. All of popular fiction has done this. At the risk of being called a geek, The Lord of the Rings, when you watch the new movies versus the old books, the major difference is the movies have gutted the lead characters of their virtue and have made them into common men who just happen to be, and women who happen to be in extraordinary situations. When I say common, I mean people whose morals are like this. But those are not the characters that were written, and that's why real fans, quote unquote, don't like the movies, forgetting the ridiculousness of the CGI and Legolas showing up absolutely everywhere. It has more to do with they have changed their identity, because the character's identity is different from old Sherlock to new Sherlock, from old, what's the king's name, Aragorn, to new Aragorn. They're different people. And that's why you don't like them. When you don't like them, is because they're telling the stories with the wrong characters in it. You want to be one of the good characters? Start with these. That's what will get you there. Okay. Thank you for that brief aside. Okay.
A gold star, I have
to solve. Yeah, right. Okay, so Moses goes through, let's kind of fast forward. Everybody knows the story to some degree. of what happened. And Moses is now out in the desert with the Israelites. And this is something, I'm just going to point to this one as a quick warning. What happens to the Israelites there, God has a lot of patience with them. You know, they do the wrong thing, God's like, he corrects them. They do the wrong thing, he corrects some of them. They do the wrong thing, finally enough times, he has the Levites put on swords and go through and kill a bunch of them. Then he opens up the earth and swallows a bunch of them. But the bottom line is, he didn't destroy them all. At some point, what did he propose to Moses? Anybody remember the nuclear option God proposed to Moses? Look, search for it. We won't do it in the interest of time right now. But go back to the scriptures and look at where God says to Moses, I'm going to kill all of them, and we're going to start over with you. What? God is sitting with his finger over the nuclear button, and he says to Moses, I'm going to start over with you. But this is who Moses is. And Moses, do you remember Moses' retort? Why did Moses say, don't do that?
Because what message would that send to the Egyptians? Because you took all this time to, you beat down the Egyptians until they relented and let us go, and then you let us all out in the desert to kill us all? What would that say?
Moses is concerned with whose reputation? Whose glory is Moses concerned with? God's glory. Ah, that's the secret. That's why God can put Moses in those kind of positions. Because God puts guys like me in the position. He's like, I'm going to wipe them all out and start over with you. And you're like, you know what? I've had enough of them too. Fine, let's do it. Let's do it. I'll be the new head of the Jewish nation. That'll work. Let's do that. God's like, should have gone with Aaron. Okay, so this is very important. Moses eventually has been bearing a heavy burden, and we want to say, let's cut that guy some slack. God, what happens to Moses? How does he triumphantly lead the people into the promised land?
He doesn't.
What happens?
He gets cocky.
Yeah, one thing happened, and what was it?
He dashes the rock.
God says, people are grumbling again. He's literally rained food out of heaven on their heads, and they're complaining that God's not providing for them. And they say, we need water. We don't, the water here is insufficient. And God says to Moses, go down and speak to this rock. We don't know exactly where the rock is. Some people think they've got an idea, but a rock somewhere in the desert. Speak to this rock, and water will pour out of it, and it'll feed the Israelite nation. Moses, who's probably legitimately righteously ticked off at the people, right? It's irritating. I would be irritated too. God's irritated. Moses instead takes his staff, given to him by God to work miracles. So, it doesn't seem like that's a terrible idea. But he hits the rock and he says, actually beforehand, what does he say? And this is, I think, the really important part. Does anybody remember exactly what he says? Must we bring water to you from this rock? He forgot for a second who's actually doing everything. Must we bring you water from this rock? All right, so what? He slips up with a pronoun, and what was the penalty? God says to Moses, because you disobeyed me, you will die within sight of the land, and you will not be permitted to enter the promised land. This is the guy who's the leader of the Exodus, chosen to take him out into the promised land, and God tells him, you can't lead him in the promised land, because he messed up a pronoun. That seems like an awfully tight definition of how tough it's going to be. Why do you think that is? I think it's because of this. When you know the law really, really well, so Carl, being a lawyer, knows the law better than most of us do, probably, right? So we all know, have heard the ignorance of the law is no excuse kind of thing, but if we got put on trial for the same offense, and let's say it's something that, let's pretend Carl was an expert in tax law instead of what his expertise is, and we messed up our taxes, Carl messes up his taxes, and both of us make the same defense of, I'm like, hey, honestly, I didn't know, this is how I conceived of it, if I did something wrong, I'm sorry, but this is what made sense to me, that's why I did it. The judge would be like, okay, well look, you're sentenced to whatever, you have to pay a fine of this, I'm gonna commute the sentence, or I'm gonna, whatever, I don't even know what the right terms is, but basically, I'm not gonna send you to jail, now you know. You should have known anyway, but don't be a knucklehead and look into it. It's your responsibility as a U.S. citizen to do so. Carl, not going to get the same treatment, is he? Carl, I didn't really know. Really? Because I'm reading several briefs here. In fact, you've argued in front of this bench before. I probably couldn't do that, I imagine. But let's say, no, I know that you know this really well. Your ignorance is less plausible to me. And as a result, I'm probably going to sentence you more heavily. If you know God this well, you know, I say this to the young men and women in the high school when I was dealing with them. They would always say this when they had their doubts, when they wanted to know stuff about God. They would say this: why can't God just show up and talk to me face to face like He did to people in the book, in the Bible? It would be so easy if I did that. The answer to that question is, He doesn't do that for you because He knows that you wouldn't obey Him, and He doesn't want to lay that burden on you. Because look how high the responsibility gets. Now, it's not like Moses was thrown from the favor of God after that, was he? He's a hero of the Israelite nation. He still lives. He was one of the two who show up to visit Jesus and his disciples on the Transfiguration. No, it's not like Moses was stripped of his glory as a result. But just be careful what you wish for. And I'm not saying that God is diabolical and is trying to trick you, or He doesn't want to get to know you. But He wants you to be holy and clean. And even if you're the most humble person on the face of the planet, when He vests you with this kind of responsibility, you're going to mess up your pronoun. You might mess up your pronouns once in a while. So if you want to know why God doesn't make you president or emperor of the world or set everything with you, it's because, you know, if you want to say it on the secular side, what's the secular version of this one?
Power corrupts.
Absolute power corrupts, absolutely. So God knows this, and so He is only going to give you, like He says in the New Testament, there's no temptation that's been has taken you except those that are common to man, and God is faithful and will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you can bear, but will with the temptation provide a way out so that you may be able to bear it. That kind of thing only happens if God knows what your limits are, and He won't put you in a place that will exceed your own limits. So here's another clue to your identity. Your identity ID is only as tough. I'm going to use that. There's a better word for that. As your will. Now, when I said there's only one thing you can contribute, look at what the things are that you do here. If these are true, I've written them on the board, so I think they're true. This is your attitude, that your will can choose to believe that you, like Sherlock said, are made you or God made you. If you recognize really, truly, and deeply, if you can meditate on, I use that word, you can focus on what your contribution is to the good things about you. And we all believe good things about ourselves, right? In fact, if we were to rate ourselves, we see this all the time. If you're being as honest as you can be, if you controlled for that in psychological experiments, people always think more highly of themselves than their peers do. And the only exception to that is like moms. Moms always think more highly of their kids than everybody else does too. And dads sometimes. Usually dads are like, no, boy, at any rate. But this right here is very important in that respect. This right here, when it comes to will, this is will choosing an attitude. This is will just choosing binary, yes or no, to something God asks you to do, as small as it might seem. And by the way, the lead up to the Ray Schoaf thing and going to Algeria was me showing up and saying I wanted to work for Bob Shull and work with the youth. Why the youth? Because I think that's a time when people have a lot of questions about their identity in Christ. I think that's really important. I think it's the most influential time that you have. I wanted to work with people in the most influential time. I came to him as a Marine recon guy, Air Force Academy grad, was inmate in charge of the asylum there, blah, 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 blah. Here's my resume. Bob, what can I do for you? Expecting he's going to be like, come in and teach classes on leadership. What was Bob's response? Who's heard this one? Someone's heard this one. What Bob asked me to do? Come be the nurse at the summer camp and put these bags on that bus for 3 years. That was what I did. This, and I learned some lessons there, and that was a good, those were all good lessons to learn. Maybe I should have spent another couple years loading bags for Bob. This right here has to do with your strength of will, and you all know what I'm talking about when it comes to strength of will. Strength of will can be reinforced by practice, but not because it makes your will stronger. I'm not going to give away the rest of the sentence. Why? And this question is one of the most fundamental questions a Christian or even a human, in my opinion, can ask of themselves. What is it that weakens will? Or what is it that prevents your will from being strong?
Flesh.
What does that mean? So we'll go more specifically. So as an example, I might will to destroy the whole universe. If I could, I would, in some sort of X-Men, whatever her name was, thing. but I can't. So my flesh limits my ability to do it, but my will is still there. I still want to destroy the universe. So I would say power, yes, it limits your power, but I mean power of the will specifically.
It's opportunity.
Opportunity?
Exposure.
Exposure. All right, and why specifically because of exposure?
There's Chris Rock has a great line about men are only as faithful as their options. It's about, you know, maintaining the proper, if you want to be faithful, you don't put yourself in situations.
Yes, yeah, absolutely. So that's about knowing the limits of your will.
Right.
And that actually gets exactly to the heart. But let me, so hold on to that for 1 second. Let me go to these two.
You said what can tarnish your will?
What prevent, let's assume that here's your willpower scale, all right? And here's a zero, and here's 100 willpower. Like, I'm a complete stoic, torture me to death, and I won't even blink. And this is a whatever you want, man. So what is it that is our will like nominally at a 50? Is it that just everybody's like, and you can kind of increase it or not? What is it that either boosts this up, or if we actually all start here, because I'd say when you look at a child, they kind of seem like they start at 100 and they work their way down from there. What is it that works you down from full power?
The wills of others.
Okay, so they can influence your will, but I go back to the Stoics and the Christians. I'm Nero. I'm going to tie Christians to stakes. I'm going to light them on fire. They still don't confess. So that does, some did, right? Some fell. But that was a necessary condition, but not necessary and sufficient. So what's did you
I think of Peter. Peter was always a zealot. And then when it came to tough times, and he really feared men and what was going to happen to him in self-preservation to take over.
Okay, that's one word I'm looking for. There's another one.
Would it be the practice of self-control?
Now, so the practice is the, in my opinion, the thing that leads you, when your will is down here, the thing that will bring it back up is practice that leads to success. The kind of practice is, oh, I can do this. That increases your will, I think. So practice will lead there, but it's not the end goal. Practice, what is it that practice gets rid of? What is it that practice gets rid of?
About desire.
I'm gonna equivocate on the term and pretend they're the same for now, but I don't want to get that nuanced yet.
I think it's competing.
Okay. Do you think you have two wills?
Yes.
Okay.
In your example, it would be the will for self-preservation versus the will to follow God's plan.
Well, Rats Sean, we are going to parse this now. I want to call that desire. And I'm going to call will the seat of judgment that chooses between those two. So let's say you have a set of desires. I will certainly agree we have two sets of desires, at least, more. But two sets of desires. But the will is the one that says, with the outside pressures, with all the things that we're talking about, with other wills pointing their ways into it, between these two decision sets, I will do this or I will do that, or that kind of thing. So that, yes. What's the other thing that gets in the way of will? What stops you? What got in the way of Moses saying yes to God saying go talk to Pharaoh? I'm going to truncate the self and just call it doubt. Fear and doubt. Let's be honest. We're Christians today. We're looking back at the story of Moses, and God says to Moses, go and talk to Pharaoh, tell him let my people go. And Moses is like, I'm not a very good speaker. This is a bad plan. We laugh at that. It's ridiculous. Ridiculous to us. Because what do we know? We know the rest of the story. We know the rest of the story. Imagine one of my favorite. Does anybody know Travis Pastrana? Travis Pastrana is a freestyle motocross guy who was the first guy to do a double backflip. He was like, he was the man in motocross. He is so good. He was so talented and so good that people couldn't even get on the grid with him and hope to win. He was just automatically going to win because he was so awesome. The best they've got, they put together a little life story thing of him, and there's a video of him at 3 years old and change getting for Christmas the little, tiny little motorcycle, you know, one of those little putters, that single cylinder, one gear type of things. And he tears it off and he says in his cute Maryland accent, his southern accent, a motorcycle, I can't ride that thing. And then the next clip they cut in is him doing a backflip across like 100 feet, you know, because it's ridiculous. Travis Pastrana saying, I can't ride a motorcycle. That's ridiculous. We laugh about that. Moses, I can't deal with Pharaoh. Do you know who you are, man? You're the lawgiver. You're the deliverer. You're Moses. Who knew this? God. When God says to you, this is who you are, and you doubt him, that's your first step to plan B, C, D, E, F, G. There is no rational, logical, consistent reason to doubt what an omniscient God says. Ever.
He talked God out of his plan A later in the story.
There
is a reason.
Now,
that is in us for a reason. You shouldn't be confined by it, and you shouldn't be held by it. But the idea of going, maybe this is not the best plan, even to people in authority, like God, there's a reason for that.
For what reason, though? What's the key difference between you go and talk to Pharaoh and I'm going to wipe the Israelites out? What was the difference? In my opinion, it's about whom was he concerned. In the one case, he doubted God's knowledge of whether he was sufficient for the task. Is God tapping me to do something I can't do? And the other one, God's saying, I take the other one, maybe I'm reading my own interpretation into it, but I take my own interpretation of this is the dialogue between God and Moses. It said that Moses talked to God like a friend. I'm assuming this is not God like whiteboarding potential plans with Moses, but that Moses knows there are things that God says that he feeds back on. In this case, the doubt doesn't have to do with whether God knew the Egyptians would or the rest of the world would take some of that. Moses is just saying this. God, don't do that because your glory is more important than what probably Moses wanted. Because Moses had gone to God complaining about the people several times. Why have you put me? He goes back to God and says, why have you put me in charge of this stiff-necked people? You know, what are you doing here? And I don't think he means it in a real doubting way. I think he's expressing emotionally the kind of stuff that we modernly wouldn't think is okay to do, but I think was actually probably okay to do at the time. So maybe I'm being too nuanced. Maybe I'm looking for my own solution too much there. But it's the same thing with Elijah saying, I'm going to pray and the heavens shut up and then pray again and the rain comes type of thing. Is that man's will overcoming God's plan? No. I think when Jesus says, was it Jesus? Paul. Who says the effectual fervent prayer of a righteous man avails greatly? New Testament, I forget. Say again?
James.
Right. I'm right on wrong on both. So ultimately, I will grant that there is something to be looked into there. But in my opinion, the difference was it's the same kind of doubt that I would say to you if, here's this buzzer that, again, because Reston Bible Church thinks I'm capable of more than I'm capable of. This is somebody gets in trouble. And there's several of us that the church puts a buzzer on. They schedule us each week. So, some guy becomes belligerent in the front of the church. I'm supposed to get buzzed and go respond to him. Now, the reality is, what's the first step I'm going to do, for those of you that know me? This buzzer goes off. Am I going to say, hang on, I'll be right back?
You come with me.
Skyler? Cop and lawyer, come with me. Okay? And Marine. Right? So it's boom, boom, you guys come with me. Alan, Sean, and Steve, you guys are in charge of the class. In the meantime, start your discussion, whatever it is. So I've forgotten my whole point at this point. The question was can you have any concerns that might say, is this the best kind of plan? I might say to you, as we're going downstairs to deal with this person, hey, do you think we ought to just knock this guy clean out? Because I know who you are, you're going to say, no, there's better ways to do it. I'm a cop. I know how to deal with this. And hopefully the Marine and lawyer is like, we're not in Fallujah here, tough guy. We're going to open the church and ourselves up to litigation. Not because I don't know, because I want to hear you guys enunciate the plan a little bit ahead of time. Is God doing that with Moses? I don't know. Now, I will say this. What if Moses had said yes? It might have been that the story would have changed and the Israelites wouldn't have been as much of a pain as they were the whole time. I don't know how the redemption story would have gone. How would that have rewritten history? I don't know. But what I do know is this. Regardless of whether you mess it up or you don't mess it up, it will turn out, because God, as the ultimate chess player, doesn't mess up a move, or even if you mess up a move, it's not that he can't counter it, kind of thing. And that's a reason to do neither one of these. Now, what's this one, I think, makes sense. There's no reason to doubt that God can bring you to your full identity. Why might there be good reason to do this? Who are some people whose identity in the Bible you're like, I don't think I would want that person's identity? Who would you least like to be in the Bible?
Judas.
Judas, okay. Well, look. Yes, correct. You're right, sir. I meant to say, what Christian or Jew, what righteous person would you not want to be?
Stephen,
right? What's your job? I'm a deacon. I'm in charge of taking stuff to widows and orphans. Oh, I'm going to be the first to get to talk publicly in a forum about who Jesus is, and I acknowledge him. And you're dead. All right. Who else would you not want to be?
Job, right?
Job. Yep. Right.
A whole book.
Yeah. Yeah. Absolutely. A whole poem of complaining. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think Elijah had some tough tasks ahead of him.
To such a point, he's like, "I'm the only guy faithful anymore, and now I'm living in this hole out here, middle of the mountain." Fear is because we fear to lose something: health, safety, comfort, absence of pain, absence of suffering. Jesus, to really help us feel good about this, says what? You better expect fear. You better expect pain and suffering, because they treated your master this way. Why are they not going to treat his servants this way? So you're like, well, that's really exciting. I can't wait to become a Christian. How do I walk down the aisle here and give my life to Christ so that I can take part in that suffering? Why do we look past this? What's a small example of us overcoming this right here? For you athletes out there. Anybody here a long distance runner? Ever run a half marathon or a 10K or anything like that? Good. This is a smarter class than I thought. For those that do that kind of thing, if you ask them, how do you like running a marathon? They'll be like, I love running marathons. They're awesome. Then you break it down and you say, I'm going to go, here's mile 1 to 26.2 or 5 or whatever, 26.2, whatever it is, 26. How much do you like it here? They're like, oh, it's kind of rough. You got the whole thing in front of you. How much do you like it here? That's where my knees are really starting to hurt. How much do you like it here? Well, that's the point where I basically have given up. And you go down this thing, and it is miserable for this entire portion. This is M for miserable. But at the end of it, once they've added 26 miserable intervals together, they get, I love running marathons out of the end of it. Now, are they just stupid? Or is there another explanation for it? What's the other explanation for it? I tend towards the first one, but that's why I don't do it. Right, drugs. The answer to all these problems is just take drugs at the end. No, but they've got beta endorphins going the whole time, right? It's already kicking off. So they got the drugs. Maybe it's the glory.
They went through something tough, but they overcame it. So,
and when you put it on the scale, and at the end of it, even after they're collapsed on the end, they say, "Do you wish you hadn't do it?" What do they? They'll tell you, "I'd have done it all over again." Glory is greater than suffering. The difference is this. Just give us 2 more minutes. The difference is this: when you pursue, if you are unsure of your glory, if you're going to run the marathon, but you're going to fall and fail at 18 miles because your own will leaks out and you just quit. That's a reason to say, I wish I hadn't have done it.
Nobody runs a marathon without a finish line. Like, nobody just goes and goes, okay, today's the day I'm going to run this marathon solo. I can mark out 26.2. They do it because it's an event. There's a finish line. There's a time. There's all of those pieces that go along with it.
And all of those contribute to glory, because the difference between running the Boston Marathon and running 26 miles down Route 7 is,
I don't get a bumper sticker for my car.
That's right. That's right. So sometimes it's not the thing itself. Now, the greatest athletes in the world, last thing I'll say, and I'm obviously out of time, my favorite surfer question, I can't remember the name of the surfer, but she's like one of the number one lady surfers in the world. She's sitting on her board or whatever, and they're interviewing her, and they're like, who's the greatest surfer in the world? And without a thought, she says, whoever's having the most fun. They assume she's going to say this champion or whatever, but if her idea is the purpose of surfing is to have fun, then whoever's having the most fun, the best surfer in the world. So that is a little bit of a surf analogy for some of what I want to talk about with identity, which is I forget the way, but we find our greatest satisfaction in him when we find our identity in him kind of idea. I know Tim Keller says something like this, or maybe John Piper does. John comes up with good stuff, even though I disagree with him not infrequently. when we rest in our identity in Christ, when we are who Christ calls us to be, we will be the most happy, which is one of the reasons that we're pursuing all this stuff. All right, so I ran a little bit over on time. Next time what we're going to talk about is the practical. We talked a little bit about diagnostically about how we're going to get there. But ultimately, next time, if you wanted to answer the question, who am I in Christ and how do I know, we're going to talk about exactly how to do that next time. And you can choose whether you want to or not. Some people don't end up not wanting to find out who they are in Christ. Because what happens if you find out you're one of the people who got a tough row to hoe? But if you're interested about who you are in Christ, come next time and we're hoping to try to answer that one. Thank you all very much.